Greetings and salutations. You've successfully arrived at the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
Greetings, constant listeners. It's Jen 2, the Rage Adams. Today, in celebration of the 30th anniversary of Pet Sematary 2, we are unlocking one of our older Patreon-exclusive episodes from the Dairy Private Library. It's a Lobstrosities episode that dates back to October 2020 and features a star-studded assembly of guests, specifically Megan Navarro of Bloody Disgusting and Brett Arnold of the New Flesh podcast. Our fellow loser, Rachel Reeves, makes one of our earlier appearances on the show, too. Together, they discuss the 90s appeal of Edward Furlong, Dream Crush, the leading man, qualities of Anthony Edwards, also Dream Crush, and why Clancy Brown, third Dream Crush, is the MVP of Mary Lambert's underrated sequel. And if you enjoy an explosive episode like this, you can get even more of them by joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/thebarons. There you can find hours and hours of exclusive content we haven't unlocked, from commentaries for your favorite Stephen King films to our in-depth archival series that goes deep into King's uncollected works to our Dark Tower spinoff series. For now, though, enjoy this episode, and I'll be seeing you over long days and pleasant nights.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. I'm your host for today, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman, leading another installment of Lobstrosities, your favorite, your only outlet for scholarly discussions on the countless Stephen King sequels that have piled up over the years. This time around, we're heading back to Ludlow, Maine to go hiking, play with pups, bike ride on major highways, and have ourselves a plate of mashed potatoes. Yes, we're talking about the one and only Pet Sematary 2, Mary Lambert's follow-up to her iconic 1989 masterpiece. You guessed it, Pet Sematary. Well, you might be surprised, because this isn't going to be your average Lobstrosities. No. Spoiler alert, but we actually don't hate this movie, and you're probably going to hear some scorching hot takes up ahead. Before we do that, before we start talking about Clancy Brown, before we remark on the heavy grunge influence here and the drama-rama on the soundtrack, I gotta introduce these guests. Look, pulling up on his dirt bike all the way from New York City is...
Hey, it is me, Brett Arnold from the New Flesh podcast, returning to the show. It is great to be here. Hello, Michael.
Oh, Brett, it's good to hear from you. You know, I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about blockbuster dollars, Blockbuster King, I believe. And maybe before that was Creepshow 3, which was torturous.
Oh, God. Yes. not a great one. A no. True Lobstrosity.
Yeah, that was definitely a true Lobstrosity. And I think I really had to struggle to say anything positive about that one. So this has got to be a relief. What is your first introduction to this movie?
When I watched it 2 days ago after asked me to do this podcast. Yeah, I hadn't seen it before. I had seen Pet Sematary, the Mary Lambert original, I think we watched it on my horror movie podcast, The New Flesh.
Yeah.
Nice plug here. I think we watched it like 4 years ago when we were doing some Stephen King stuff. And I never grew up watching the Mary Lambert original, so I have like no nostalgia for it or anything.
Interesting.
And I thought it was like, yeah, I thought it was fine. And I've never loved the original movie. I thought it was very TV movie-esque in the way it was like put together, which I know a lot of people love that movie, and I'm sure most of your listeners do. So you may have picked the wrong person today, buddy. Just kidding. I actually really ended up liking this one.
Mm-hmm.
I think just because it's so trashy and like more deranged than the first one. And it just has no, you know, there's no Stephen King's Pet Sematary 2 as a book.
No, not yet.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they're just, you know, it's a classic case of a studio just saying, fuck it, we're going to make a sequel. And for that, you know, factoring that in, it's actually pretty commendable what they've done here.
Yeah. Well, we're not alone on this discussion. We're not alone on this trail. There's a station wagon approaching. Who goes there?
Hi, this is Rachel Ryder Reeves from Boise, Idaho. Record store employee by day, freelance typist writer by night.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, what is your first introduction, or what was your first introduction to this film?
I saw this years after I saw the original, and to be quite frank, I didn't even know it existed. Mm-hmm. When somebody told me there was a Pet Sematary 2, I was like, wait, what? But there's no book, right? It was like actually really confusing. But then I saw it and legitimately loved it. There's a lot of stuff in this film that really works for me. So I'm very excited to hear from everybody about what they enjoy about it.
I'm very excited too. This is interesting too, because I believe when we first discussed this film on our Pet Sematary run in 2018, I think Mel Castle might have been the one that was like really praising it, and I think all of us were like, eh. But I too have like kind of similarly found a fondness to it. I'm excited to talk about it. But wait, before we can climb, someone's riding down the hill on a bike. Who's that?
Hi guys, I'm Megan Navarro, the lead critic for Bloody Disgusting and co-host of the Bloody Disgusting podcast.
Great to have you on. You were one of the first people to respond, actually, to my prompt on Twitter about if there are any Pet Sematary 2 heads out there. And you wrote a pretty incredible dissection in defense of Pet Sematary 2 at a time when I don't think most people were actually even defending this movie. I was actually pretty surprised at the response and reaction to the outpouring of love for this movie, but I don't think that was the case in 2017 when you published that piece for the 25th anniversary.
No.
Have you always loved this movie, or have you kind of found a reappraisal for it yourself?
I mean, I watched it when it was pretty brand new on video because I was such a huge fan of the original. Mm-hmm. Watching it way too young. But I didn't connect with it immediately because it is so drastically different. But then over the years, like, once you kind of take it at its own film, not really as part of the Stephen King's book series, then yeah, there's a lot to love about this movie. So, I mean, I caught on to it much earlier, but not right away.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's something about the replay factor for this film that has stuck with me, because for me, the first time I had seen it was not in theaters. I remember seeing the posters just because I was a huge Eddie Furlong fan, just because, you know, as a kid growing up with Terminator 2. And so I remember seeing the poster, but I don't think I ever really watched it until it like hit Sci-Fi Channel or something like that. And I was like a latchkey kid growing up. And so, like, the idea of these kids, like, running around this small town with these fucking zombies chasing after them, basically, like, that just, like, really scared me, especially the dog being possessed. So, it was one of the movies that I guess, like, I would just catch scenes for the longest time on television, never seeing the full thing, until I think I sat down to watch it, like, sometime in the aughts. And it was just like, oh, wow, okay, this is definitely a spirited sequel compared to what I probably expected watching like the pretty dour original, because I just love Pet Sematary is one of my favorite books by King, and I actually think the adaptation is one of the finest adaptations. I mean, it helps that King wrote it, but like it's just such a wild detour with this one. So excited to talk about it, but let's get to, you know, but we gotta head up to the Mi'kmaq burial grounds, and while we're heading up there, we gotta talk about the, you know, the history behind the sequel. And we're going to do that in a section we call Shit a Concordance.
Hey, you people! This ain't how Americans act! We gotta stop this!
The original was a huge success for Paramount, released in 1989. It grossed like $58 million on $11 million budget. So clearly the suits were like, all right, we gotta go back to Ludlow. They tapped Mary Lambert again to return, and you know, she had a different vision for this sequel, one that actually really aligns with one of my main interests in the King's Dominion, which is returning to L.A. Creed. And she wanted to basically return to her character years and years later when she's a younger woman. And she was going to return back to Ludlow with her cat. And I believe based on, we talked to Mary Lambert about 2 years ago. God, is it 2 years? Yeah, 2 years ago still, when we were doing our Pet Sematary coverage. And she actually had teased this idea to us saying, oh, yeah, you know, I wanted to do an L.A. Creed story and Paramount wouldn't let me, which is really infuriating because I think that would have been a really cool narrative arc to go on. And she digressed on that arc with Bloody Disgusting, I think last year, maybe for... when the new movie came out and like the 30th anniversary release was. And she basically said that Ellie would have been in Chicago at the end of the original movie. So I'm pretty sure her grandparents wouldn't have sent her back to live alone in that house after all that had happened. So I would just take the point of view that Ellie grew up in Chicago, but what had happened to her parents was not very discussed very much. I would have jumped ahead to have her be a young woman and I would have her go back to Maine with their cat. And then she kind of talks about like a bunch of like feral felines and all this other stuff, but it just sounds so really fucking cool. And as for me personally speak, I've said a bunch of times in this podcast how much I'd love for King to go back to the character of Ellie, because I think it's such a, there's so much there. You know, she has The Shining, basically. There's just so much story that you could tell. And the fact that the Pet Sematary is still up there, you know, and Ludlow's been mentioned in passing throughout the books, it just would have been cool to do. But anyway, that didn't happen.
It's so funny, though, because they made Ellie the focal point of the remake, yeah. Which, but they did it in such a way that it just, you know, was basically a marketing gimmick. Like, I don't understand the way that they did that at all in the remake by changing the main, you know, impetus of the plot, basically.
It's interesting.
It was interesting, but then they basically made a whole play about giving it away in the marketing. Like, they had a whole press kit to be like, this is what we're doing, and don't worry, we're not going to change Stephen King's original too much, but we want to tell you ahead of time. And I'm like, it's a great idea to change, make it Ellie, the person who, what, you know, I'm trying to talk around it. But it's crazy to me that they, like, undercut themselves by then revealing it in the marketing when it would have been such, like, a big moment in the movie to, wow, this is what it's going to be. There's a heel turn, actually.
Yeah.
But they totally gave it away.
And they don't spend enough time with it in the remake either. Like, I think that's my biggest problem with it. I love the fact that they kind of shake things up. And I think what they do with having Lewis spend time with Ellie as, like, you know, the dead, is really interesting. And I kind of wanted more. I would have wished that they were able to get to that a little faster as opposed to doing like kind of beat for beat stuff from the original story, because that stuff is really compelling. Like the bathtub sequence with like the staples, the scalp, like I love that stuff. And I feel like that actually is more in sync with what Lambert tried to do with the sequel, where it was just like, all right, well, I'm going to go there. Like, we're just going to have fun with this medium, you know, this idea that the dead would come to life. And I'm just going to explore how wild we can get these themes and how crazy we can get the narrative. And that sort of boisterous ending, without spoiling too much of the remake, which most people have, you know, if you're listening to the podcast, you've seen it. And I imagine, Megan, Rachel, you've seen the remake, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
I have. I liked it. I think if you're going to remake something, like me personally, like I want to see something different. I'm not a huge fan of remakes that just, like you said, like beat for beat, repeat what's already been done. So I appreciated their, you know, attempt to put a little spin on the story. Yeah, I do agree, though, that maybe if it was withheld a little bit, it would have had a little bit more potency. But yeah, I enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, and then I remember when the trailer hit, that was like the biggest, it was just like an explosion on Twitter. Because we had been waiting for it, I knew it was going to drop. And then when we saw the reveal in there, I just remember Twitter. It was incessant that.
Well,
that
I avoid trailers, and I even knew about it because, yeah, like, as I mentioned, they went out and gave an interview with, like, I don't know if it was Rolling Stone or somebody, but they were like explicitly talking about the reasons behind the move to change it to Ellie. And I'm just like, the movie's not out yet.
I know.
Like, why are you doing that?
I just remember there being a ton of discussions online being like, well, it doesn't really matter about the spoilers. It's not going to really change the trajectory of the sequel. But I think, or the, you know, the reception of the movie. But I really do still wish they would have withheld it, because it would have been
I think I would have, like, I also don't think it's that bad of a movie, but I think my experience was definitely tainted by walking away being like, well, they gave away their one thing.
Yeah.
Their one, like, big change.
Yeah. Well, Megan got to go to the premiere. I remember that was a big deal at South by in 2019, because I remember they had, like, a lot of, like kids in parades wandering around. Like, I saw photos from it, but... what was your take on the sequel, the remake? Because I know that, I mean, do you think that there are some sort of like spiritual alignment with the remake and this sequel?
Before the premiere, I actually did the set visit for Pet Sematary. So, you know, I went up to, I think it was outside of Montreal, and it was a Friday the 13th. So it was extra cool to be in that cemetery and just see how like meticulously detailed it was to the books. And I don't know that definitely wasn't the intention right away to reveal the Ellie twist, because that was something, I mean, it was a really small... There was only four of us that night, and it was a scene where, well, I don't want to venture into spoilers if somebody hasn't seen the movie, but when you're on a set visit, usually you're watching the scene from like the video village, right next to the set. And sometimes you'll see, like if you're paying close attention, you'll see them kind of rewind stuff. So two of us happened to notice, as big fans of the book, that there was something really off. There was a child in a mask that's not in the books. And so we're starting to conspire. And then the scene being filmed, you know, he's calling out for Ellie in a scene that it would not make sense. And I'm like clicking that, they're swapping it out, which makes sense when you see the child who plays Gage and he's like 2 years old, itty bitty, you know, way smaller than the Gage in the original. And I'm like, okay, this is what's happening. And then you see the publicist's face kind of like, oh shit. So I'm not sure that was ever the intention. I don't know if, you know, them realizing that there was a possibility that this would come out in the set visit reports kind of contributed in any way. I'm not going to be presumptuous to assume that, but and as far as your question of how I feel about it, I actually like it. Is it perfect? No, but I kind of like the idea that it's a remake meant to exist as kind of a supplement to fans of the novel. I mean, it exists on the same shelf where it's like, we made this for fans, but we're putting our own slant on it, so it's not an exact duplicate. So I really liked that they were going for it, and that it's meant to exist in this same kind of space.
Yeah, like it is kind of weird how like collectively the three movies have like this strange connective tissue to it. I mean, obviously this is a direct sequel to the original one, but like I still feel like the energy, especially in that second half of the remake, feels almost like a spiritual homage to this, because with this one, you know, it's balls to wall crazy. I mean, and that was by design. It wasn't like happenstance. It wasn't like, you know, happenstance, or it just didn't happen by accident. I mean, like, there's literally, like, Lambert was interviewed in LA Times as recently as last year, and she said that, you know, Pet Sematary 2 didn't get as much love as it should have. I actually wanted to make her an irreverent movie that had a lot of dark humor in it. I knew it was not going to be as scary as the first movie because we didn't have Steven involved, so I went for that from the very beginning. And what is the worst thing that could happen to a 12-year-old boy? What if his mother marries the hard-ass sheriff, and the hard-ass sheriff in town becomes your stepfather? But actually, no. What's worse is if the sheriff dies, you bury him in the cemetery, and he becomes a zombie. And now you have a hard-ass sheriff zombie as a stepfather. Honestly, that's funny to me. Like, I read that quote just because the fact that that was like the initial conceit of this movie makes me appreciate this film even more, because it's like, it would have been, I mean, if could you imagine if they made a sequel to the original Pet Sematary and it was just as dour? Like, you just follow another, like, they almost do like the Ghostbusters 2 thing where they just kind of redo the original story. It's like, well, here comes a new, you know, a new family that comes into town, and you know, there's a tragic death and, you know, we have the same rigmarole that happens again. What's great about this is that it kind of feels like they just took the black humor of that final ending where he's embracing his wife with Rachel and where Lewis is embracing Rachel and there's like pus gets coming out of the eye and you're just sitting there just being like, this is fucking crazy. Like this is, you know, like a Peter Jackson movie at this point. But and I love that they just made like a 90 minute or, you know, 100 minute movie on that. And so I don't know. I think the boisterousness really works. And I think it makes sense. And this is something that you talked about in your article, Megan, that Richard Outten was the screenwriter. And if you know, and Richard Outten's got a really strange career. He was uncredited for, I mean, he had a lot of undeveloped screenplays that happened, including one for The Goonies 2, which I'd kill to read that screenplay. But he also wrote for like Briscoe County Jr., which is just perfect camp. But really, he was uncredited for Gremlins 2, The New Batch, which, I mean, I think all of us here have got to be fans of that movie. That's just, it's probably the most essential balls-to-the-wall crazy sequel that you could do. I mean, set the bar for it. So it kind of makes sense that this movie would follow suit. I mean, Megan, what do you make of Outten being here? Because it is strange that he doesn't have too many credits to his name outside of that. Like, it's, I wonder if he's just, his brazenness is what kind of kept him on the fringe in Hollywood.
I honestly have no idea what the selection process was for this. I'm curious because, like you said, Mary Lambert had an idea and they were like, nah, we don't really want a teen lead. So let's go with this guy because he knows Zany.
It's insane. Like the stuff that they come up
with. They really capitalized on the Furlong being in Terminator. Like that has to be the entire impetus for casting him, right? Like it wasn't like the summer after.
Yeah,
or am I getting my timing wrong?
This is so. I have some really wild notes for Furlong for the next section, but I do think that the fact that like Paramount was like, no, a female lead, a young female lead's not going to sell. Which is ridiculous when you think about some of the movies at the, you know, at the time and even before then. But so they, I guess like, you know, they're probably, I could just imagine the suits being like, oh, who's that boy that was in a, you know, James movie last year? you know, the kid that was, you know, screaming along with Arnold. And they like, you know, they spend like 5 minutes doing quotes. And then, you know, they talk about whether or not they can get Robert Patrick. And then finally, you know, a rep comes back and is like, ah, it's Eddie Furlong. I have his number on the, you know, on the line. I could just imagine. Yeah, I'm sure Furlong was the big deal because I mean they pretty much center the whole movie around him. I mean they like I'll talk a little bit about Edwards in a bit in the next section, but like it is his movie.
It totally worked. My husband, when I was telling, you know, I was watching it and he's like, man, I remember when I was a kid, because he loves Terminator and loved Terminator 2. When that came out, like I wanted to see it so bad because of Edward Furlong, and my parents wouldn't let me because it was too scary. Like that was his only association with Pet Sematary 2. He's never actually seen it, but he remembered like how bad he wanted to see it just because Edward Furlong was in it.
He was such a
see the marketing movie. Executives are sometimes right.
They are.
Know what they're doing. That's, I mean, that's lasting impact.
He was the he was the original bad boy for me. I mean, like you had at the time, I was born 84, so for me it was like, oh wow, who's Bart Simpson? And then wow, Bart Simpson in real life is Eddie Furlong. Like he's fucking hacking ATMs, and like I still use the term easy money. Like every time I pull cash out of an ATM, I say it to myself, and the person behind me is probably like, "Who the fuck is wrong with this guy?" But anyway,
is he referencing Edward Furlong?
Yeah, they turn around, they're like, "Terminator 2." I'm like, "Yep." And then we get a long discussion, and it's like, "Well, Nick Stahl's pretty good at John Connor, also." But anyway, last few notes on the history of stuff. Stephen King actually had his name removed. He kind of had, this is kind of a bad time for King adaptations. This is like literally the same year, I believe, that Lawnmower Man comes out. So he's just fucking vitriolic at this point. Just like they're ruining my works. But so he took his name off of this. And I don't know if that really hurt it too much, but you know, film premiered August 28th, 1992. Can't even imagine what I was doing at that time. Probably getting ready for school. But debuted at number three at the box office and grossed only $17 million. So less than half the box office of the original one. So not too great for Paramount, but turned out to be a cult classic. So we're still here talking about it, and yada yada yada. But does anyone else have any notes for the history of the movie that I didn't go over? This usually just the section for me where I just like literally just read fact after fact. So I apologize. It's not too much of a discussion in this area, but if we have any other notes.
No, I just think it's worth pointing out that like the executives not wanting to cast a female lead in their movie is something that like, it still happens today, I feel like, where executives just misguidedly make these grand gesture decisions where they're like, no, that won't work. And it's like, it's been proven to have worked so many times since then and before then. And it's wild that how many movies we've been robbed of because of shit like that. You know what I mean? Like, not even just females, but like diversity casting. Like you listen to like the history of like the Batman movies and like who was almost the Joker.
Yep.
And like all those type of things. And it's like, God, studio executives really shaped the casting decisions for so long.
It's wild how like some of the most like iconic movies would have just been totally fucked over by the suits. Like, yeah. I was listening to an episode recently on like Escape from New York, and like the studio is adamant on having like Tommy Lee Jones or who was the other one they had? I think Nick Nolte for Snake Plissken, which I guess on paper at the time, I'm sure that would have made sense. But could you imagine if like either of those, like, it's just like, and Carpenter was like, no, I want Russell, you know, I want Kurt Russell. And it's like, I can't even imagine if like the studios got their way sometimes with some of this shit. I mean, they do. I mean, they did here, which is clearly what, you know, happened. But it does still happen. I wonder if it happens as much on the TV medium, you know, if they get, you know, filmmakers in TV get their free reign a little bit more, you know, but.
Yeah. I was looking at the box office for this weekend too. It was beaten by Honeymoon in Vegas and Unforgiven.
Oof. Yeah. Well,
Unforgiven in week four.
Yeah. That's rough. That's really rough. It's even rough for like the, you know, the talent that's involved too, which I mean, with Mary Lambert, it's unfortunate too, because, you know, she's coming off of this blockbuster success. You know, 89 is such a good year, huge year for her. You know, she gets, you know, Pet Sematary, Like a Prayer video, like is arguably one of the greatest videos, like of all time. You know, going up there to rival with like Thriller. And I do think that this kind of set her back a little bit. Like, and it sucks because it's like, it was a project that was given to her through Paramount and they didn't even really give her any agency. And it's just like, I don't know. I fucking hate Hollywood sometimes.
That was all I was getting at, basically.
You know, it just really sucks. But one thing I did forget to mention is that Academy Award winner tied to this, Russell Carpenter, no relation to John Carpenter, I don't believe, but he the Titanic cinematographer did this movie. So
whoa,
that's pretty wild. And also he also did The Lawnmower Man, so there's some King's Dominion there. How about that?
Lawnmower.
Oof, rough. Rough. That was a previous Lobstrosities. Yeah.
Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, there is a Game Boy game, in a Sega CD game. That was another movie where like the suits were like, this is going to be huge. We need to have.
Yeah.
We need to make Lawnmower Man merch. And when you actually look at the origin of that story, you're like, how the fuck did they ever make a movie about that? But anyway, let's go to the next section. That I like to call the caca tet.
Do they have guns and bullets in your world?
You're gonna like Earth a lot.
All right. Well, in this section, we're gonna talk about the cast and crew of Pet Sematary 2. We already talked about him, Edward Furlong. Now, what is everyone's relationships with Edward Furlong? Is he overrated, underrated? What do you think, Megan? What are your thoughts on Edward Furlong?
I think. Overall, a little overrated. He's great in Terminator. He does really well here, you know, for what his character is. But he just kind of goes on a steady decline after, you know, Brain Scan. Yeah. It's not really him that makes Brain Scan memorable, but the trickster and just the outlandishness of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he just kind of faded from there. So, you know, he had stellar casting and, you know, James Cameron to work with that got his career like a much needed boost right out the gate. But yeah, I can take him or leave him.
Does he work as Jeff Matthews?
Yeah, I mean, for what his character is here is like a, I mean, he's a teen boy. He's an angsty teen boy who misses his mommy, and he does that well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love, like, he still kind of has that, you know, like whenever in Terminator 2, like when, like, you know, the T-800 picks him up, or like the T-1000 knocks him around, he has that kind of like weird sort of like, hey, you know, like kind of squeal to him.
Squeaky voice, yeah.
Yeah. So I loved hearing that. I thought that was good. Brett, what are your thoughts on Furlong? Are you for or against?
I don't have super strong feelings. As I said, I didn't grow up with this movie. I was born in 1991. I'm going to age myself. I'm very young. I'm a youngin. So, like, I grew up, I was going to say, my first, when you think of Edward Furlong, I think of watching Pecker on HBO.
Yes.
Because it was like a movie called Pecker, and I thought there'd be boobs in it or something like that. That is what I remember watching. And I remember seeing bits of American History X. And Detroit Rock City, he's in,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, love him in Detroit Rock City.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I like, you know, I know that era, Edward Furlong. So, I just, not super strong feelings about him. But Pecker's a fun movie, if I recall.
Very fun movie. Got some fun little notes just on him in a second. But, Rachel, what do you think about good old Eddie? What does he work in this movie for you?
Overall, I'd say yes. I think that when it comes to like moody stares and like sullen attitudes, like he can't be beat. Like he plays that character so well. Because honestly, I don't think he really has to try. I think that is Edward Furlong for the most
yeah.
part. You know what I mean? Like it's very authentic, and he totally captures that angsty young teenager. And in a lot of ways, I think that was kind of leading. You know, later in the 90s, I think a lot of teenagers got really sort of cast that way or portrayed as really apathetic and lazy or spoiled and kind of that, you know, generalizations. And I think that he really does capture that in this film and mm-hmm. even in Terminator. When it comes to emotional range, not really convincing.
I know.
You know, when he's like crying and screaming, like I don't necessarily really believe it. But when it, you know, for the most part in this film, I think he does pull it off pretty well.
Yeah, I think what's interesting with him is that he really was kind of like the 90s Corey Feldman. You know, like someone who was pretty much awash in a lot of controversy. This is pretty much the beginning of a really wild decade for him, and that's pretty much what he's got. I mean, it's pretty wild that like this is his immediate follow-up to T2, probably not the greatest choice, and he probably had it already maybe insecure, like secured down.
I'm assuming he got fucking paid for this movie. That's like all I can think is they just like most of the budget for the movie was probably to this kid.
Well, it's like he clearly was, you know, taking advantage of his celebrity at the time. Because I mean, like literally like 2 months later, he released an album in Japan.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. It's called Hold On Tight. And it has like a cover of The Doors, People Are Strange. Which, hey, a link to Corey Feldman. It's the Echo and the Bunnymen cover for the Lost Boys. But it's so, yeah, holy he has holy. An album in that. This is where it gets crazier. It gets so fucking crazy. So the same time, he starts having like a kind of a relationship with his stand-in tutor, who is like 28 Uh-oh. Years old.
Extremely 90s shit going on.
Right? Yeah. And like, so I guess apparently like this is coming straight from Wikipedia, but like when California's statutory rape law changed in 1994, it allowed like the prosecution of adult women with like having sex with minors. So like his uncle actually pressed charges, but like it's crazy to think that like, so Pet Sematary 2 comes out and he's like pretty much in a relationship, you know, behind the scenes with a 28-year-old who's literally probably teaching him on set during this movie. And I know it's given that wild ride, and this is before he got really into like the drugs and alcoholism, like he kind of recovers big time. Like I mean, after this he goes from I mean, we mentioned Brain Scan, but he worked with Jeff Bridges in American Heart in 93. He goes and works with Tim Roth and Vanessa Redgrave, actually, in Little Odessa in 95. Meryl Streep and Liam Neeson in Before and After in 96, which, God, I remember my mom dragged me that movie and I just was like dying. But
I was going to say, I'm surprised you remember. These are all movies that do not exist. Like, I cannot up imagery of any of them.
But I think maybe what most people remember him for, but I think this whole stretch is just, I think critically great for him. But like, what I think people really remember is like, it's just a total like blank window of like, all right, well, you have the early era of Furlong where he's got this Terminator 2 and Brain Scan, which I remember for sure because that was like, I had the same type of hair. I was really pudgy, but like, I really wanted to be Edward Furlong. I thought he was just the fucking coolest kid. I had his action figure, which was like hard to find from Terminator 2. So it was really fun. But then it's the later era stuff that I think a lot of people also remember where, you, as you mentioned, Pecker, Detroit Rock City was a big one. And then obviously American History X. And that's kind of it. Like, he just vanishes. Like, the aughts are just not kind to him. And I guess it makes sense. I think it's right. I think the emotional range kind of really hurts because he really could only play like the bad boy because that's who he is, you know?
My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, was... He had like drug addiction problems.
It's sad.
If I recall, he was supposed to be in Terminator 3, but then they got Nick Stahl instead because it was like right around the time when he was like not doing very well.
It's kind of like you could almost say there's like a John Connor curse because if you think about it, like, all right, so he starts off as John Connor in Terminator 2, some major problems. Nick Stahl stars as John Connor in 2003.
Right.
He has problems also after that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was after Terminator. It wasn't even before. Like, he was pretty fine after that. And then you have Christian Bale, who stars as John Connor and literally gets in the huge like controversy for like the leak tape that comes out with it, or Terminator Salvation. And then, I don't know, I don't really got anything for Jason Clarke, but I guess
we've still got time.
Yeah, but hey, there's a link. Link, Jason Clarke plays John Connor in Genesis. I believe they are both in Ludlow in Pet Sematary, the remake for Jason Clarke. So there's your link there. But anyway, do we have any more thoughts on Furlong before I move on to the next principal cast member?
I think that sums it up.
All right. Well, next up is Anthony Edwards. I kind of always forget that Anthony Edwards is in this movie.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the leading men of this franchise are pretty stale.
Yeah.
Totally. 100%. I agree about that.
I mean, how many leads in movies are veterinarians?
I know. Yeah. I mean, trying to think
I love that. It's something I enjoy about this one is how they play up the pet thing. So to me, like, that's like a really endearing thing about that. So I will say that I support the lead vet.
His character isn't the problem. It's just something about being like the father in these movies where you have to be as bland as possible. Like Dale Midkiff, he's not good.
No.
Anthony Edwards, he's boring, even when he's supposed to be in like peak action scenes. And you know, Jason Clarke probably fares a little bit better than both, but still, you guys are sleeping.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the problem is that so much of like, especially the Lewis Creed character, you're in his head in the book. You know, like literally the first time you meet him, he's kind of like, all right, I gotta ditch this family and just drive down to Disney World. And like, I think that's like in the third or fourth paragraph of the book. And I think one of the things I think we joked around with Lambert was like, well, Midkiff was really hot, and that was like the best part of his performance. I think that and like, you know, him taking the shot to the head when he falls off the bed. But not very interesting. And what's weird for Edwards is that this is kind of a really curious time in his career. You know, he is still like years removed.
It's pre-ER.
So he's around, he's in Northern Exposure at the time.
But post-Goose.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say post-Top Gun. Yeah.
Which he never was able to really capitalize on. Like, he has this wild early run where he's in like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He's in Revenge of the Nerds. He goes and does, Top Gun. And then he just gets really interesting with his choices, but they just don't work. Like, one of my favorite roles of his is in Miracle Mile, and like one of the more underrated gems. It's such a fucking good movie, but too bleak, and I just don't think it worked. But like, still curious choices. And I love him in that movie, and it's just I just don't think he really ever found his footing until You Are.
Yeah.
So, and it kind of, you kind of get that sense of meanderingness to him here. Like I almost like get the sense that he doesn't even like, he definitely doesn't realize what movie he's in this movie.
No.
So
it's crazy to think that he like, yeah, you're made me think about his career and what it could have been, I guess, after Top Gun. Like he was next to Tom Cruise in like one of the biggest movies of that time.
Yeah.
And he ended up being on like a network television drama that I watched with my mom. Like, how did that happen?
Well, I don't want to get into like appearances, but as someone who's like terrified of, who's constantly worried about losing hair, myself, I wonder if that had something to do with it, because it's like, you know, he
I wish
gets...
we were zooming so I could show you my humongous bald spot on my head.
Oh, well. I'm literally, it's my girlfriend loses her mind because every other day I just get up and I'm just like, I don't know why I'm losing it. And then, you know, so like, I just sound like Jack Torrance just wandering around my house. So yeah, I mean, I do wonder if that's kind of why, like, maybe
I don't think it's the hair so much as he's not your conventional leading man. I mean, you look at Top Gun, where he's standing next to Val Kilmer and Tom Cruise, and he's just like your sweet boy next door type, not like your action takes charge romantic lead. So I think he just maybe was not figuring out the parts that he does well. Like, he doesn't pull off this character well, but he totally pulls off that sweet endearing doctor type, or, you know, the partner who has the tragic moment in Top Gun. Like, he just, Miracle Mile, he's the sweet romantic lead in an overall bleak movie. Like, that type of role is what works really well for him.
Yeah, I agree. I think it doesn't help that he's always been paired with hunks. Like, if you think about, like, ER and also, like, the Zodiac even, Mark Ruffalo. Hollywood needs
he's
that.
He's found his niche and he's doing, I think I also wonder sometimes if when people pivot to TV so hard, I just wonder maybe this person enjoys the schedule of television more than doing movies, which is such a different thing, you know, or the stability or anything.
That definitely happens.
It does, you know. Well, look, I think we got to go to the star of this movie, which I think all of us wanted to talk about him. Mr. Clancy Brown. Oh my God. If you want to talk about someone who didn't know he was in the movie, like, this is the direct opposite. This guy is the movie and knows exactly what Lambert is trying to do here. This might be I don't want to say it's my favorite Clancy Brown, but it's pretty up there. Like, this is just such a fucking tour de force performance from him. He's insane. In this, Rachel, go off. Like, do you think that, do you agree? Would you agree with that Clancy Brown pretty much owns Pet Sematary 2?
Oh, 100%, without a doubt. Like, he, like you said, he understands what the movie is, and he embodies it, and he exudes it. And, you know, in the beginning, we get the arrogant asshole, and then at the end, it's just full camp, and it's just so, I mean, the mashed potato scene, I like can't get it out of my head, like that whole thing. I don't know if there's a list of like top mashed potato things, scenes in movies, but like, it's up there with Close Encounters.
I was just gonna say Close Encounters,
you know, like,
we all have that one in the chamber.
It's so great, and he just he makes the whole thing for sure, without a doubt.
He's terrifying in this. He's legit terrifying, and also at the same time, surprisingly charming. Like, even in the beginning, like, I mean, even though he's a total shithead and a misogynist, like, I there's something about him that I find. I think it's the swoop hair. I'm just gonna say it's the hair. Like, it's his hair is great in this. Like, he looks great. Megan, what are your thoughts on Clancy Brown in this?
This would be, if nothing else, Clancy Brown is the sole reason to buy a ticket or rent that VOD, whatever. Like, he is the definitive reason to watch this movie. I love him so much. And we're talking about how Edward Furlong doesn't have any range. He's just that one beat angsty bad boy. Clancy Brown demonstrates a wealth of range in this movie alone, from intimidation, like, he's very sinister and intimidating and imposing as a villain, but also likable. He's really a jerk, but then there's you can see why his wife would marry him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like Rachel said, the mashed potato scene alone, like he embraced, he's the only one, as far as I'm concerned, who knows what type of, well, that and the mom, but
yeah,
those two are like the only two actors that know what they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And they chew scenery like nobody's business. And I love it.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. And he's, there's so many like the, when it comes to like the one-liners, almost like he's, it's not even really one-liners per se, it's just like this sort of the delivery, I guess I'd say, it's just like all the delivery of the lines are just so like,
yes,
they're like an EC Comics like, you know, parable. I like love it. So I don't know, Brett, what about you? What do you think?
I was sold when he introduces himself to Edward Furlong by basically saying, hey, kid, I fucked your mom like,
yeah, like
30 years ago. Your dead mother. Like, it's an insane way to introduce the character. And
at
I,
a funeral, too, right?
Yeah.
Where he says it.
Yeah. It is absolutely out of control. And from there, I'm just like, that's like, there's so much deranged human behavior in this movie. And most of it is from Clancy Brown.
Yeah.
And yeah, he really does make the movie. It's just, when I think about this movie, I will think about the bicycle scene. I will think about the mashed potato scene. And yeah, everything comes down to Clancy Brown, who I didn't know until just now is the voice of Krusty Krab, Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob.
Wait,
I don't
really?
Know why I didn't know that.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, like,
he's also
like
crazy voice acting career, apparently.
Yeah, I know that he, well, he's in the Mortuary Collection this month, which is like a total transformative performance.
Good. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put that on tonight.
He's
but...
voice in Crash Bandicoot of Dr. Cortex. So
wait,
he's
what?
80s and God of War 3.
Well,
yeah,
there are a lot of weird connections, because honestly, he's pretty much a Rolodex in Hollywood when you think about it, with especially with genre, but like, he's got connections to Anthony Edwards because he was in Revenge of the Nerds 3, the first Edwards-less revenge movie. Multiple connections in King's Dominion. He's going to be, you know, he was in Shawshank 2 years later. He's in this. As you mentioned, I didn't know that he was in SpongeBob, but in SpongeBob, the voice, oh, God damn it, I forget. The voice of Patrick, I believe, is also the... who's the actor from Coach? He's also in The Stand. So there's some, you know, some connection there. But I mean, Buckaroo Banzai, Blue Steel, Tales from the Crypt, the guy's everywhere. Like, he's fucking everywhere. And like, I love him. It's just, he's, and apparently he's like the nicest guy in the world. I've never met him and I've never talked to him. But like, everyone, from all accounts, I've heard that he's supposed to be great. He's like an awesome person to talk to. But I don't know.
I think that he really helps the film kind of avoid some of the pitfalls of the original. You know, I know everybody's, you know, got their opinions on the original and it is amazing, but there seems to be, my problem with it is that sometimes the pacing and some of the emotional tone of it gets a little bogged down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, Gus's character in this, like, really just keeps the momentum and it keeps the humor and it just brings the movie back from some of those little bit of slower, kind of more subtle moments. And
yeah,
so I think it just, like, his character and his performance just, like, it does, it makes the movie and helps the whole thing become more effective and more enjoyable.
Yeah.
I think because you've got the human element there, like the first movie, you have a cat and then you have a toddler. And it's not finally, you know, it's only in the final moments that you have an actual formidable villain. You know, Gage is great. He's a little creepy toddler, though. And here, yeah, you've got this jerk before he even transitions into something worse. Like, how do you make this monster into a bigger monster? We're going there. So he's got more of a satisfying arc, I think, and more of a presence than a cat and a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a perfect point.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about it that way, but that makes total sense.
It's like they have just more fun, you know, and like,
yeah,
it's they have the opportunity to be more fun, because it's like, you know, you lose an animal, that sucks. You lose a kid, that's you're the worst in the world. But like, you know, a bunch of assholes being buried, like all the like pretty much all the people, with the exception of the mother, are like pretty awful people that are buried in this. So it's like, you know, it's kind of like one of the parables that Judd shares in the first one, where the Timmy Bannerman is, mm-hmm, buried and he comes back and you kind of see the goofiness a little bit, even though it's not really, I mean, actually for me, I think that scene is, the whole thing is terrifying, and especially the way they describe it in the book. But the idea of it and the kind of kookiness of it and the fact that like he's living in a house with them, you only see it in glimpses, so it's scary. But like if you really think about it logically, it's this. So, and to see it play out is really fun. And it's kind of going back to like with the remake, it's like that's what I want. I wanted all of that. Like if they had a whole movie where you just have like the dead living in the house, like fucking sign me up. I'd love it.
I also really, what I enjoy about Clancy Brown, and I guess the movie in general, is that this movie has some of the most vicious movie bullies I've ever seen in my life.
God, like, yeah. It's so cruel.
They steal his kitten and then construct a dummy of his dead mother's likeness, yeah, and tricking him into believing she's returned from beyond the grave. Like, what happened to stuffing kids in lockers? This is a little too far. But Clancy Brown becoming dead and then going to fuck that kid up is like the most satisfying thing ever. It's great. Yeah.
It's this weird pretzel, like Hammurabi's Code, or like karma. Like it's a weird sense of karma in this movie. That I guess morally probably doesn't add up all the way, but you know, whatever. I love it. So let's move on to Jared Rushton, because I think all of us recognize him from all the movies that we had on VHS or DVD growing up. Like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Big, Lady in White, even Overboard, if you're, you know, wanted to go way back then. Jared Rushton, to me, this is an opportunity for him to be a total asshole in ways that he's always been like the punk kid. Like in Big, he's hilarious. Is like, you know, the attitudinal, like, you know, sidekick. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, he's just such an asshole brat. But like this, like, yeah, like you're saying, Brett, like this, he is such a fucking asshole in this movie. Like, I can't stand him. Like, like I always get pissed off when he like pulls up on the motorbike and all Edward Furlong is doing is just like riding his bike. And he's just like, well, you know what? What I'm going to do is I'm going to throw you off the side of a highway.
I'm gonna ruin your fucking life right now. Yeah, he's horrible.
For no reason. Like, he's totally Ace Merrill from, you know, the King's Dominion, and I just love how much of an asshole he is. What does everyone else think about Jared?
Oh, he's a bully for sure. Just like what you guys are saying. I mean, a kitten, like, come on. Like, you're really gonna like take some kid's little kitten and then I don't know. Yeah, so he is definitely a good bully. He was a good casting there, I think.
Yeah, great casting. You definitely want the entire audience with you when you're going to have an adult kill a kid, you know? And they did a good job, because I was totally rooting for him, especially in that scene, because Clancy Brown plays it so funnily. Like, the whole, like, he's kind of surprised by what he did on acts, like, it's almost an accident. And then he just kind of keeps going with it. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan, what do you think about Jared?
You've all said it. I agree.
All right. Well,
yeah. What more can be said?
Let's talk about the other great presence in this movie, Darlene Flugel. I believe that's you say that Darlene Flugel. Tragically, she passed away in 2017. Hell of a resume. She was in Eyes of Laura Mars, Once Upon a Time in America, To Live and Die in L.A., Running Scared, and she was a regular on Crime Story. I think is the dead mother. Like, I feel like she knows the right... She's, again, like Brown. Perfect tone for this movie. Like, at times, like, almost feels like she's, like, a deadite in, like, Army of Darkness or Evil Dead 2. What do you all think about her?
I think she's channeling Mary Lou from Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2.
100%. Yeah. Wild. Like, the ending in this is... It's so maniacal and so cartoonish and so larger than life. And it's all largely indebted to her. Like at that point, like she just takes over the whole thing.
You get Clancy Brown out of the movie. What do you do to fill that gaping void? She does it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting too, how she bookends the film. Cause I really like the opening scene too. Mm-hmm. Like I really like how the whole thing, especially if you're going into it blind, like just how that opens.
Oh, like
up
the
there.
Movie, the fake movie.
Fake movie, and just her interaction with, you know, Edward Furlong's character, and just that whole part, I think is just really great. And so it's nice to bring her back at the end, and she just one-ups herself. I think it's great.
Isn't it odd how similar the the opening of this movie is to like the opening of New Nightmare, which would arrive like 2 years later.
Yeah.
You know? And now like that you what, say
Seed
it,
of,
yes.
Seed of Chucky many years later.
Oh yeah.
I feel like true. So many movies have done that now. Yeah.
Yeah. The opening with her pretty much sets the tone for the rest of the movie. Like, you can't take it seriously. Like, it's so insane. Like,
it's like an opera.
Yeah.
Just yeah, like the huge opening. Melodramatic Grand Guignol, like.
Yeah, like a MC Escher, like watching the water drip on the thing that's gonna end up killing her. Like, it's a pretty suspenseful sequence. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I love it. Well, we got two more characters. I'm just gonna pair them: Lisa Waltz and Jason McGuire. Not much to say about Jason McGuire, Georgia actor. Me and my friends growing up, we used to always quote the line where he's just like, you know, Edward Furlong pours his heart out, and he's like, yeah. Let's get out of here. Like, I just we used to use that line like all the time. Just kills me. But he's all right. He sells the fear there. But I think Lisa Waltz, total veteran actress, been in half a dozen things. Like, or no, dozens of things actually. I mean, I recognize her from X-Files and My So-Called Life. I feel absolutely awful for her in this movie. Like, probably the only real source of like goodness in this film, in a way. Like, you know, she's kind of pure spirited. Like, she's just in a shitty situation. Like, I knew so many mothers growing up like that were stuck in this fucking situation where it's just like, oh well, you know, he's an asshole, but you know, we're getting by. Like, and that was like the real sense of like realism in this movie comes from her. I don't know if I'm alone in that and thinking that, but.
I kind of feel that way about both the Gilbert family. I mean, mm-hmm. Jason McGuire isn't nearly as strong as she is, but he's still plucky enough to mm-hmm. where they are the source of purity when everybody else is making terrible decisions or selfish-based decisions or just flat-out evil. Like, these two are the representation of how this, you know, evil is corrupting in knocking out good people. Like, they're, you feel for them. Even like Jason's not good, but he's character is good. You feel for his character and his love with his dog and even his bond with his mom. And like you said, you feel stronger for the mom, for Amanda Gilbert, over anybody else. But yeah, I think they're the innocent folk that get caught up in this madness.
Yeah. Yeah. And that the death is brutal. Like, even rewatching it, I know it's going to happen, but I'm still so shocked. Like, if there's anything like that's like a parallel to the original one, like, I feel like that's like their gauge moment, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just brutal. Like, it's I guess if you like listed out everything that happens, it's pretty comically brutal with like the potatoes. And then also, I mean, it just feels almost like a Hot Shots Dukes part Dukes like scene or whatever, but like, it's pretty harrowing. And I, that whole sequence, I remember growing up just like give me so much anxiety, like, cause it just, there's such a sense of hopelessness that really kind of ekes out at that point. But, do you have any other thoughts on, Lisa or Jason?
Well, I think just what you were talking about, like, it's not expected. Like, you didn't expect that to happen. At least I didn't. Like, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, okay. Like, that just happened. Yeah. And so I think it is, like a shock factor moment, I guess, because they are so good and so like sweet and kind of like innocent the whole time that it makes their, you know, their death have carry more weight.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No pun intended.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It rewatching it the other night, my girlfriend audibly gasped. Like, she was like just on her phone, just like looked and then like looked up and she's like, wait, they died? I was like, yeah, he throws them, like, either basically, you know, pummels the car into a fucking, you know, probably one of the same trucks that killed Gage, you know, 3 years earlier. But
yeah, that scene is surprising.
Just so fucking relentless. Well, let's move on. Let's go to our next section. Fun section. We like to call Beam Breakers.
Why does the man in black want to destroy the tower?
The tower protects both our worlds. If it falls, hell will be unleashed.
Look, this is pretty much the most important section. We have four Lobstrosities episodes. This basically asks, does this sequel take the name of the King property for marketing? Does it actually capture the spirit of King?
This
is a tricky one because he has that can mean so many things, the spirit, you know, of King. Yeah. And I think you could argue for or against it here. I think yes, because King does have a pretty warped sense of humor a lot of times, and this definitely is a warped sense of humor. It does have that kind of small town vibe that he does, you know, that he's known for. So, I mean, I would argue that yes.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. When I knew we were talking about this, I was trying to think, like, okay, what if it did say Stephen King, you know, on the cover? Like, would that feel out of place? Or would it make sense? And to me, it makes sense. Like, that wouldn't seem weird. Like, it wouldn't seem like, oh, this is a poor Stephen King thing. I think that they took King's works into consideration, and there's a lot of things that do make sense. Like you said, the small town, the teens, the dark humor. There's a lot of things that I think that they were trying to do, and I think that they were making a valiant effort to keep the spirit there. And overall, I'd say, yeah, I think they do succeed.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's a good test. If it had Stephen King on the cover, would it be weird? And I think no. I 100% agree that if you told me Stephen King had a hand in this in some way, or like a, you know, gave it his blessing, I would totally believe you, because it does have that vibe. And as I've said earlier, I don't have any nostalgia for the first movie because I didn't grow up watching it. And I actually feel like an ass for saying that, especially because I read the book for the first time like this year, and it was just, you know, it's probably definitely one of my favorite horror books I've ever read. It's just so good. And I don't think any of the movies particularly capture what I love about the book so well. Each of them, I think, does like portions of it for different reasons. Like the remake has like that whole third act part. I really like the vibe of it, but I don't think the whole movie worked. But my point is, I really want to rewatch the original movie after having read the book and see if I feel differently.
Yeah.
Because I also have only seen it one time, and it was like 5 years ago. And, you know, sometimes a mood can affect how you feel about a movie. And I feel like I'm not giving it a fair shake, especially considering how much I enjoyed this one. I feel sacrilegious liking the sequel that is like an unsanctioned sequel than to the original that people like, you know?
No, I mean, still, I think that's
contrarian.
I've seen people talk about how they like Dr. Sleep more than 1980s The Shining. Like, I mean, I don't know. It's wild.
It's a good movie, but yeah.
Well, I know. But there's
Stephen
but it's
King
out there.
Is probably one of those people, though.
Oh, absolutely, he is. He still talks about it like nonstop. But I don't know. I'm somewhere in the middle too. I think that even the goofiness of this movie kind of speaks to King's sensibilities. Like, you go read some of his short stories, and especially like Skeleton Crew, or definitely Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which was pretty much coming out around this time, maybe a year later. They all have that sort of tall tale humor and horror to it that's all over this movie. And there's certainly homages to a lot of the works that he loves best. I mean, like, King loved the Evil Dead series, and like, I feel like this is so similar to the Evil Dead, or like the Raimi style. And I think that's kind of intrinsic to, you know, his own sensibilities there. And also, like, yeah, the small town charm is all over this. Like, if anything, that's like the one thing that like kind of keeps it tied to the original. And for that, I guess it does still feel like it's respectful or mindful of King's work in ways that like a lot of sequels aren't. Like, we like the previous Lobstrosities we did was The Rage, Carrie 2, and I like really went in and supporting it because I actually thought that they did, you know, a lot of people argued on the episode that the connective tissue there was unnecessary, but what I argued was that, like, well, they didn't have to have that connective tissue, but they tried, and like that try there is important because, you know, it'd be so much easier to not have it. And like the fact that they did shows that they were kind of respectful there. And I guess you could kind of argue if real cynical reasons that they only had it just so they can keep the IP and use it for branding purposes. And yeah, sure. I'm sure that's the suits at Paramount wanted to do, but the people that were actually in the driver's seat really, you know, tried something different. I think Lambert does here too. I mean, they set it 3 years after the original. You know, they acknowledge the Creed's the Creed murders. I mean, they have the campfire scene where they're basically the whole Creed family has turned into an urban legend the same way that any of the other characters that were involved with the Micmac Burial Ground previously were, you know, like the Bannermans, you know, all the stories that Judd told. So I like that. I like that link there. I love the idea that they walk by the mailbox with the house, even though it's not the house because they filmed this in Georgia and not in Maine. It still looks like it. And I always love when you can watch sequels and you can see like that sort of, you know, not that this isn't really a slight touch really, because it's literally right there in the foreground, but I always like when they do like the subtle nods to like the past and it's not so overt. And that's certainly the case here. And there's also some weird King connections. Doing some research, I found out that the monster arm prop was used at the beginning of the film is actually the same arm of the skeleton used in 1990s It miniseries, which is wild. Did some more casting links. So, you know, Furlong's here. In T2, his mother is Linda Hamilton, plays Sarah Connor. Linda Hamilton had starred in Children of the Corn, so there's the King connection on that. I think the way that when Gus is chasing, I forgot his name, his stepson, basically. It's kind of like The Shining, you know? It's very similar to like how he's opening the door with the hammer. And apparently, according to IMDb, they say that, I think I take this with a grain of salt, but the scene where the mom and her twin daughters are going into the Dr. Matthews' office to look at the kittens could be a nod to the Shining where they walk down the hallway. I think that's a little stretch, but
that's stretched,
right? Yeah, yeah. But either way, I think we all agree that very respectful. It doesn't break the beam, so. Let's move on to the worst moments in the movie in a section we call Cry Your Pardon.
No! No!
All right. What do we not like about this movie?
I'll start. They were mean to the kitten.
Yeah. No, that's what I was going to say, too. There's a lot of animal violence in this movie. So if somebody's, you know, if that's an area of sensitivity for somebody, like, there is a decent amount. I love the amount of animals, but they're pretty rough on them.
Yeah. Is there a no animals were harmed tag on this? I didn't see one.
Oh, there's got to be. There's got to be. Yeah. I will say that's why Randall Culver, my co-host, wasn't on this episode, because he doesn't like to watch any
animal. Is that right?
Quality. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. One thing I think is really funny about this movie is when Zowie first comes back from the burial ground and his eyes are just like not even blood red, but like CGI red. They're just so red. Yeah. And it, like, I'm pretty sure the parents of the kid just act like it's like, oh, here's your dog. He's back. Like, take him in.
He's fine.
He looks like the most feral thing on earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could do without the scene, the dream, the nightmare sequence with Anthony Edwards. Like, that to me is this does not belong in this movie at all.
No.
No, agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
It feels very forced to me.
It's very out of place. Totally. It's like, we don't know what to do with Anthony Edwards. He's so boring. So let's put them in this goofy dream sequence.
It's so goofy. Like, my notes are like, Manhunter Blue sex scene with the dog.
Zowie.
Like, Zowie, yeah.
Okay. Which,
why? I mean, did they just need to have nudity in there for the sake of nudity? And like, it was just like, all right, well, hey, look, you know, we're coming off the 80s. We got to get some nudity in here. And we got to get some trash and make it slimy and grimy. Let's just have a little bestiality here also. Like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, it's wild.
I don't know. Was it supposed to establish him as a more capable and, you know, present dad? Like, I just feel like you've already spent so much time making Edward Furlong the lead in this movie. Dad could just show up at the end and be like, whoopsie, you were right. Mom's alive. Or I don't know. Like, this was not a necessary scene, and I cannot figure it out unless Anthony Edwards is like, let me look like a badass.
Yeah, yeah.
it was in his contract, like The Rock does for the Fast.
Yeah, I don't get enough horror action, so let me get with Zowie.
Yeah. He's like, he walks in, he's just like coked out of his mind. He's just like, look, if you don't give me a fucking sex scene, I didn't rip it. I'm just going to lose my shit.
Give me leading man scene, yeah. Stat.
You know, ridiculous. It just, that was my number one gripe, is because it's just so loony. Like it's loony for the bad loony. Like it just, it's so irreverent. Yeah. Like it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Exactly.
To me, it kind of pairs too with the character Marjorie, like the housekeeper shows up. She also seems really forced, and I feel like it's kind of a similar thing, like, oh, make Anthony Edwards a leading man and have this like weird dynamic with this, you know, young woman that's in their house. And at the end too, I don't like how they kind of like pit the women against each other, and she's got like this weird admiration, you know, like fangirling basically, and like wearing her clothes and stuff. I don't know, that whole character just doesn't really work for me and doesn't seem necessary. Like I don't feel like she adds anything of value.
I almost wondered if they were trying to kind of harken back to the first movie with Missy, and mm-hmm. Missy was a very eccentric housekeeper, and they're like, let's do that again as some kind of really bizarre connective tissue. It doesn't work, but that was kind of like, maybe that's where they're going. I don't know.
Yeah. God. And that story is so dark. Like that, just like the loneliness of when she kills herself in that, oh God, that scene still like gives me the creeps. But and she also, she looks a lot like the mom. So it's like, were they trying to make this like fucking Vertigo situation here that's going on? Like where, you know, oh, I'm still, you know, I'm attracted to this person, but I'm also not, I don't know. It just felt very, it just felt unwieldy, like, you know, or wieldy, like it didn't work at all. And one too many storylines. I just think that you take that out, you can simplify this a little bit more.
We're blaming Richard Outten for that one.
Yeah,
he's applying the new batch aesthetic here.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the main theme got a little redundant, like when the age of DVDs, when you'd fall asleep and then like the menu would be playing, and like they would just play like 45 seconds of like a theme over and over again. Yeah. Like that's what it felt like with this theme, like the, like over and over. And then like sometimes you get the vocals in there and then maybe sometimes not. Like I actually want the vocals, because I was like, all right, let's give me something to work with instead of the same guitar line that sounds like the beginning to like, I don't know, like a Metallica track from that era.
Yeah, that was me in college with the Arrested Development DVD menu music. It's like a 15-second loop, and it would play all night. It was crazy.
What a nightmare! That's a coarse theme to have playing on repeat.
The score doesn't really do anything to contribute to like the emotional undercurrent at all. Like it's very tied to the action and like what's happening on the surface, and I think that like a really good score helps support the characters a lot, and I mean it doesn't do any of that in my opinion.
No,
I actually like the insert songs more, because totally. It's like, oh okay, obviously like this is just like a fun background song, cool, like that makes sense. But when you're trying to use the score in that way, it makes it really obvious and feel kind of jarring almost.
100%.
And it kind of takes away from what is happening. So sorry, Mark Governor, don't hate me.
I think he'll be all right. I think he actually has a wild career that I looked up before, where he had, so I guess he writes songs too. So like he's been in like, and there's your SpongeBob SquarePants connection there too. He is a TV series writer on that. Like, and he actually wrote a song he did the Jellyfish Jam, I believe.
Funny.
And he had also, he wrote the songs Fading Away and Love Never Dies in this. And, oh God, that's wild. So like, I guess more recently he's worked with Alexander Payne to do like Downsizing Nebraska. So he's doing fine. I think he'll outlive this one. But yeah, and also like I will say the insert songs are great. Like John Rahm is awesome. I like the Ramones song, Poison Heart. I mean, it's not as catchy as Pet Sematary, but still a good song. Not bad.
Yeah.
You know.
Funny little personal connection. So there's a song by the Nymphs in there. That's really great. And a woman I work with at the record store, her husband was in the Nymphs.
Oh, wow.
So that's really funny to me. I'm like, oh, wait, that's Sam's band. Like, that's fun. Like, that's awesome. I know somebody who is, you know, on the outskirts of involvement.
I would have loved, like, if, so this is like 92, if they just like went like full on Cameron Crowe singles and just like every other fucking, you know, scene is just like a song from like Pearl Jam's 10 or, you know, like Soundgarden's, you know, like one of their first two albums or something like that. Just like go all in on the grunge and just like these popular singles that take you totally out of the movie.
They totally should. I mean, almost. They almost did. They got L7 and they got Jesus and Mary Chain and the Ramones and the, like they were close. They should have just, like you said, they should have just gone all in.
They'd be like,
they should have just played Pet Sematary by the Ramones again. That song is unbeatable.
I love that song. Would have been funny, if like it closed out again, and like that was like, it's like almost like the Bourne Identity with Moby's Extreme Ways, where it's like, well, in the Pet franchise, the theme song, we're just gonna keep closing out with the
correct
Ramones.
Me if I'm wrong. Doesn't the remake end with a like Star a dark, song. Scary cover of the Ramones song?
Yeah.
I think it was Starcrawler. Yeah. One of the other things I didn't like that I just started cackling over. And I do this with The Stand also, is the ending with like the, when they put the photos over when they're like driving away. Like the video of like everyone who died and passed, like, oh hey, remember who passed like 90 minutes ago, or, you know, the last 90 minutes of your movie? Like,
in case you forgot.
It's just like we're like, why layer on like the melodrama? Like, it doesn't really mean, you don't need that. Like, because at that point it's like, you've already had this like insane boisterous ending, and then to go back and dial it back and be like, look who we've lost. And it's weird. Like, I don't,
in loving memory.
Yeah. Like, I always laugh when they have that, like, especially at the ending of movies when they show clips of scenes you literally just watched. Like,
yeah.
Like, remember this? It's like, well, no, I didn't have any time to have any sort of nostalgia because the fucking movie's still on. Like, how the hell is, you know, it's such a weird motif that they would do all the time in the late 90s. I think it works a little bit better in Mick Garris's The Stand just because you've been on that long journey. But, like, yeah. I don't know. It's still kind of sappy.
Like, Platoon had that type of ending, but it kind of worked there because so many people die that you're like, oh, yeah, I didn't remember that guy.
Yeah. And then they put the villains.
But otherwise, no.
Like Gus. Like, go ahead. God. Like, they put the villains in there. Like, oh,
can
Gus died.
Oh, God.
It's like, what? Yeah, it's very weird. I'm trying to think of anything else. Is there anything else that kind of got stuck in the crawl? Nothing? Well, hey.
We all really like this movie.
I know.
Think, so.
That's why I think
the highlights there.
Well, I think the next section is going to be great because we're going to be talking about the highlights in a section we like to call You Have Not Forgotten the Face of Your Father.
I do not aim in my hand. He who aims in his hand has forgotten the face of his father. I aim with my eye.
Well, I'm just going to say it right now. I think the best thing in this movie, we've talked about him the whole entire time, Clancy Brown. I mean, if you want to talk about something being effective, Mr. Brown, my
MVP.
Hat's off to you. Yeah.
Gus.
Yeah, I mean, that whole sequence, like I mentioned before, when he's chasing the kid, going up the stairs, you got the wolf chasing after him too. The mother comes home, immediately buys into what's happening. They get in the car. It is just perfect, relentless horror filmmaking, I would say. But what else do you really love about this movie?
Mary Lou ending.
Yeah.
This absolutely huge over the top, like, she looks like Mary Lou. We've got the whole fire thing going. If you're gonna go for a grand finale, I feel like that actually, from a visual standpoint at least, is more exciting than the previous movie.
Yeah. It's inspired. And you could definitely tell that, like, Lambert's like absolutely flexing the muscle from her like music video history at this point.
Same with the opening. I think it's a really nice bookend. Mm-hmm. Like you said earlier.
Yeah.
I wouldn't rule out Mary Lambert getting the money, or that maybe she, I don't know if she has the interest, but I feel like if anyone wanted to throw Mary Lambert money to make the Pet Sematary 2 that she didn't make, like the Ellie Creed one, I feel like there's an appetite for that, and it would do well.
I agree.
Maybe, but you know, honestly, I kind of don't know, like, if we're going to spin off like this or do remakes, there's so much town history with the cemetery, not this single family. You could spin off so many stories, like even some of those stories that were hinted at or even discussed in the book. Like, let me live in Ludlow a little more, people. Like, do something with that. Ellie, I think there was a window for Ellie's story, but now I'm ready to see somebody outside of the Creed family.
Yeah, the idea that around the time that the remake came out last year, Lorenzo Di Bonaventura went to interview with Dan Caffrey, co-host of The Losers. He actually asked, like, oh, well, you know, you were talking about a prequel, or would you see a sequel to this or something like that? And he said, well, yeah, a prequel would be great because there's so much lore in King's original novel that you could mine. And I agree. I mean, like, could you imagine like a 1920s set like Pet Cemetery would be like terrifying.
Right. Or even just get into the Wendigo. Like, the remake only hinted at it. There's a whole lot of Wendigo stuff. Give me that.
Yeah.
And that is something I did like about this one a lot, is just that they expanded on the burial ground. I mean, visually.
Right.
And, you know, just a whole other story involving that. Like, they show you more than I feel like that they do in the original, and they make the scale and the scope of it bigger.
Exactly.
And I think that that's awesome. I think it's great. And I'm so glad that they went that route, for sure.
Yeah.
It's like we had two houses on a busy street in the first one. And now you feel a little bit more lived in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I want like a Dawn of the Dead style, like Pet Sematary 3, where they just go all out.
Work.
Yeah. Or like a Land of the Dead. I mean, like, just go all in. Because it is cool, like, how... Yeah, like, I mean, some of the implied history and getting into the town lore, it would be really eerie and creepy to have that stuff go down. I don't know. I don't know if it'll ever happen, because, I mean, the remake was a success, but
not enough. Probably.
Yeah. I feel like that was kind of like the first moment where we got pretty much like the first chink to the armor of Stephen King, the renaissance that's happening. Like, it was like, oh, well, okay. Swing and a miss there a little bit. Even though it wasn't, though. That's the thing. It's so weird. That's like the most perplexing thing that happens. It's like, actually, all of the Stephen King adaptations last year is the most perplexing thing. Like, they were all successes. Like, It Chapter 2 was a huge success. Like, it still was, like, I mean, we talked about this, Brett, and, like, the blockbuster thing. Like, it made so much money. It's, like, it's still in the top five, I think, highest grossing horror movies of all time. But yet, it's, like, considered a flop because, like, I guess the reception itself wasn't, like, as resounding as the first It. And then it's, like, the same thing with the remake for Pet Sematary. Like, the critics actually it was pretty glowing. And then it actually made money. So I just don't get it. Like, I don't know. But it's the aftermath, I guess, is what counts. But anyway. I also really like the direction here. I think Lambert's direction is, like, when it's really, like, crisp. Like, it really captures, like, the fall season. Like,
Halloween.
Beautifully.
Am I crazy to say it looks better than the first one?
I think...
Is that just my bias against the first one?
I think it might be the bias. Like, I think aesthetically the first one is amazing. Like, I think, like, people forget there are some amazing establishing shots of that first one. Like, I always think about the ending.
I gotta rewatch it.
Like, there's, like, ending where, like, they kind of do the speech that Judd says again, and it's right towards the end before everything stops. And they kind of do all these amazing like shots over like the nature that surrounds the Creed house, and, you know, the truck going by, and like the town itself. It's just really gorgeous shots that come back here. I mean, she's an amazing filmmaker. I mean, like, there's some really, really awesome shots and portraits, like when they're at the quarry, like where they're like at the river or whatever. Like, there's some awesome shots there. I love the uses of brown and reds that are in this movie. And then when it's a really nice juxtaposition to like the more Michael Mann color palette tones that happen when it gets into the more music video territory. But yeah, I don't know. I thought that was great.
I love the Vertigo shot when they're like crawling up, you know, the dam basically, you know, to separating the cemetery from whatever's beyond it.
Yeah.
And it just makes it seem like such like a big like presence that's alive. Just that one Vertigo shot every time, I'm like, oh, I love that so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And they oh, go for it.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, the fact that it wasn't in the same location, I mean, because they shot outside, like, around outside Bangor for the first one, so it literally is, like, you know, true Maine setting. The fact that they were actually still able to kind of mimic that in Georgia is, you know, there was applause there for that. You know, it didn't feel like a totally different town. Like, when you watch, like, you know, Rob Zombie's Halloween, which was filmed in Pasadena, and the second one where it's like, hey, it's still Haddonfield. And it's like, you actually get into like a Midwestern vibe because you're in Georgia, or I think it was Georgia or Carolinas where they filmed. I don't know. Either way, it looks totally different. Like, it doesn't look like the town anymore. And so I like that. I like that that there's still feels like the history is there. And the Mi'kmaq burial ground even looks the same. You know, they get the rock that looks kind of like the rock it has. Like, the pet cemetery inside looks like the pet cemetery. I think they did a pretty good job with the set dressing.
I love that Mary Lambert went on to direct a movie. I actually, last night I watched Halloween Town with my fiance because it's on Disney Plus and we have, you know, I haven't seen it since I was a kid. But Mary Lambert directed Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge.
Yep.
And she also directed Urban Legends, the third one that was straight to video after Urban Legends and Urban Legend and Urban Legends Final Cut. She did the Bloody Mary one.
Oh,
which
interesting.
My manager of the movie theater I worked at in Evanston, Illinois was an extra in, and he talked about it a lot.
God. Yeah, I mean,
not a great movie, admittedly, Bloody Mary, if I recall. I haven't seen it since the year it came out.
I've only seen the first one. I've never actually.
Oh, really? Final Cut is actually great.
Really?
Totally recommend it. Yes.
Okay. A lot of like early aughts actors in that one.
Total Scream knockoff, but it justifies its existence.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, Halloween Town 2 is apparently better than Halloween Town 1. My girlfriend's a huge
yeah,
fan.
I can't wait.
Gotten a little discussion with Mary Lambert on Twitter, which is funny. She was like freaking out. She's like, "Oh my god, I can't believe she responded." And it was pretty funny. So we had to watch it that night. So yeah.
So anyway. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. And Calabar, great. What a villain.
You know what I noticed? This is gonna be for nobody. But in the credits for Halloween Town, the first one, Calabar is spelled with a C, and in the second one, in the title, it's with a K. And I just wanted to put that out into the universe.
I'm glad we had that. It's like when they mess up Michael Audrey or Aubrey Myers in the Halloween trivia.
Yes.
Yeah, well, pretty sure I'm the only one that had noticed that one when I was little. But do we have any other things that we want to gush about with this movie before we offer our final thoughts?
I do love Zowie. I'm not going to lie. I'm a big dog person. And I think Zowie, yes, as an actor, does a great job.
Yeah.
Love that's a good dog.
That's a good doggo right there.
Yeah. Genuinely terrified of that dog when it goes evil.
Yeah. It does great. And, you know, just like I don't like the violence against the animals, I also love just the presence of so many animals at the same time. Yeah. And... yeah, it's just a cute, fluffy puppy.
Yeah. I recall growing up the taxidermy scene when it like does the quick pans over all the heads, like really unnerved me. Like it got under my skin. I remember that. Just being like, wow, that's who the hell would ever want that in their room?
Yeah.
I don't really get that. Anyway, anything else? All right. It's time for our final sacrifice.
Don't just sit there. Seize him, punish him, cut him down, I command you. I am the word and the giver of his laws. Disobedience to me is disobedience to him. Do it now or your punishment shall be 1,000 times, 1,000 deaths, each more horrible than the last.
All right, we're going to offer our final thoughts on Pet Sematary 2, and we do this on the grading scale of 1 to 5 dumb-a-chums, with 5 being the worst and 1 being the greatest. Rachel, kick it off.
You know, I really enjoy this one. I think its overall sense of humor and self-awareness and the way that it pays tribute to the original while also becoming its own very unique thing is just fantastic. So I'm going to give it 2 dumb-a-chums.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. Brett, how about you?
I am going to give it 3 Dumb and Chums out of 5. Is that right? Am I doing it right?
Yeah, no, 5 is the worst.
Five is the worst. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So 1
I'm
is
I'm
going
to go with 2 then. Yes. 2. I really enjoyed it way more than I expected, especially coming in pretty cold on Pet Sematary, the first one and the remake. And having read the book recently, I was surprised to find that, you know, the kind of what I assumed was a knockoff sequel that has very little affiliation with King ended up being very enjoyable, very fun, and definitely in the King spirit. So, yeah, 2 Dumb and Chums for
awesome.
Me as well.
Awesome. Megan, what about you?
Jeez, I don't know. It's a 2 or 3 because there's a lot of problems with it, especially the Anthony Edwards dream sequence, or maybe just Anthony Edwards in general.
Yeah.
So I can't really say it's a great movie, but it's a movie I thoroughly enjoy. Obviously, for lots of reasons, at the top of the list being Clancy Brown. But to me, this is also I like a really sassy, feisty female director, and to me this is that, because Mary Lambert had to do this movie. She got shot down for the vision she wanted to do, so I feel like she was like, fuck it, I'm going full camp, try and stop me. And so we got this pure goofy movie that is so much fun to watch.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's where I'm leaning also. I think I'm gonna go with the 2.5. And I'm going to reference Mel Castle again. I think she really hit the nail on the head back in 2018 in our initial discussion on this, when she said that she likened it to Evil Dead 2. And that, you know, you watch the first one, Evil Dead 1's terrifying, even though there are some quote-unquote campy moments, but they go full-on in the camp in the second one, and there's not really much terror or horror. It's just kind of balls-to-the-wall, zany, wild action. And I think that's the same thing here. The only difference is that with Evil Dead 2, you're able to follow someone like, you know, Ash, who kind of grounds the proceedings a little bit, because you know everything he's gone through with the first one. There's a familiarity there. So whatever happens is fine as long as he's around, which is one of the reasons why I think, you know, the series works and yada, yada, yada. The only real recurring thing in Pet Sematary 2 is the town, the Micmac burial grounds, and, you know, the stories and the lore. Mm-hmm. And so there's a comfortability that comes from it. But so, like, you know, I was thinking, like, who am I really latching onto? I mean, like, I guess arguably it's Edward Furlong's movie in the sense of narrative. But, like, the only person really that interested in the entire film is Gus. Like, he has a pretty great arc. And for that, like, it makes it almost like the movie Maniac Cop 2 or Maniac Cop 3 in a way. Like, it's almost like it's like weird anti-hero that you just keep following. And it's not even an anti-hero, just like a total villain. But I kind of love it. And so when I look at it that way, I appreciate it a lot more especially when I couple it with the fact that it's just Lambert going all in on the sensational. So yeah, I mean, I think it turns out to be kind of like a wildly manic midnight movie in that respect. So yeah, I think 2.5 for me. But yeah,
this would be such a great. Maybe it's already played the music box of horrors, but like this is a perfect festival horror movie
play
at, like, you know, 2 a.m. or something.
Yes,
it would be so fun
because you need those movies. Like I remember going to the music box of horrors like 5 years ago. And they started, they put Possession on it like 2 or 3. And like before that, we were all, it was like gung ho. Like all of us were just like, yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to get to the end. And the end is like noon the next day. And after Possession, we were like, all right, I want to go home.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to sit in those fucking seats for so long.
But even just like a movie like that, it's like a gut punch. Yeah. You don't want a gut punch. You want something that's going to get you like your blood going and like, you know, your heart racing a little bit. And that's this. Like, it's so much fun.
It's perfect analogous, I would say, is at the first music box I went to, which, God, must have been like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago. The 2 a.m. or like just after midnight movie was Texas Chainsaw 2. Like, that's perfect.
It's a perfect one. And it's very similar to this. I mean, it's
exactly.
It's totally tongue in cheek.
Like, tone wise.
Well, folks, I hate to say it, but it's time to leave Ludlow. I want to thank all of you for making it out here. You know, I know it wasn't easy getting up here in this these burial grounds. The Deadfall can be a little tricky. I mean, Brett, you almost broke your neck when you were walking over there on that run branch. But look,
I gotta be careful.
We gotta go. But before we go, let's do some plugs. So, Megan, tell us what's coming up.
Oh gosh,
so much. Yeah,
so much. I don't even know where to begin. You can listen to me weekly on the Bloody Disgusting podcast. I am forever busy on Bloody Disgusting. I have 3 articles coming out in the October issue of Fangoria. I'm everywhere.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Keep
up with it on Twitter at Haunted Meg.
Definitely will. And you're probably going to have, guesstimate, how many reviews do you think you have in October? What you got coming up?
Oh my god. I just getting teary thinking about it.
yeah,
at
the
least
night stream stuff 40 coming in today.
Yep. 40. Oh my god. I mean
there's like, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot between Fantastic Fest, which granted isn't much. There's a couple of Salem Horror Fest. There's definitely Night Stream. And that doesn't even cover the nonstop barrage of October releases that keep
Keep adding. Yeah, here's the witches. Have fun.
Yeah.
God.
It's like, come play. I forgot that was coming out, but I got an email this morning. It was like, all right, that screener's coming. Holy crap.
I know.
I actually just watched that before I got on this. Yeah.
Well, and then also, they just the Beyond Fest too, which was, I had to find someone in LA recently for that, but the horror movies are just nonstop. It's weird. It's like horror won this year for sure, because all of them are able to get out on VOD and digital. But it's also
virtual screenings are great.
It's awesome.
It's great, but at the same time, it's bad.
Yeah,
you know, it's not, also, not even yeah. for my yes. workload, just yes. for like how many titles are going to be remembered a year from now.
I 100% agree. I already forgot. I saw 20 movies at Fantasia Fest, yeah. and I could tell you the names of like 3 of them.
Yeah,
exactly.
Crazy. Same.
Yeah,
same. Well, Brett, what do you have on your docket?
Listen to the New Flesh podcast. We're out every Monday. We are a horror movie podcast about all things tangentially related to horror. And we used to do, you know, current theatrical releases. Now we're doing deep dives of franchises. We did Psycho, we did Texas Chainsaw. We did so many. I can't even remember. But right now we're doing Halloween for the second time because it's the 5th year anniversary of the show. So we're doing an even deeper dive into Halloween because we never gave each movie its own episode. So we're doing that. And I also was on an episode of Hoff's Public Domain Horror Fest last night, which was a blast. Hoff's Public Domain Horror Fest is a weekly comedy horror screening, I would describe it as. It's like a movie, kind of MST3K style, where he interrupts it and hasn't really interrupted, but he like edits himself into it in funny ways and kind of just like Sven Gulli style hosts it. So I was a guest on that last night as they watched Little Shop of Horrors on YouTube. Yeah, it's a really fun show, and the idea is, you know, it's public domain stuff so that everyone can watch along via this just YouTube-produced show, and it's really a really fun time, so check that out as well.
Sounds great. Rachel, what do you got going for spooky season?
Yeah, so I'll have some Salem reviews still coming out over on RoomWorg and Film Cred, and then Nightstream stuff will start here pretty soon. I'll be doing that for RoomWorg. As well as my normal stuff for Nightmare on Film Street. It's October. this month is the Sound of Screams month on Nightmare on Film Street, which has to do a lot with music and scores and sound effects, and that's kind of my area of interest. So I'll have a lot of stuff coming out for that, which I'm really excited about. And you can find an article related to that in the next issue of We Are Horror, which comes out here in a couple weeks.
That's awesome. Yeah. No, it's I've always talked to Brad Misko about this, one-on-one about he always says like October is just such a fucking nightmare every year. And I'm finally starting to get that with us just doing horror nonstop now. And it's just, oh my God, it's relentless. And it's fun because you're like, oh, well, you know, I love doing all this stuff and I love horror and I love being able to watch the movies. But yeah, I mean, Megan, you're right. Like I honestly, like, it's hard to enjoy a lot of this stuff, like, because it's so relentless. And I do wonder how much am I going to really remember after this year, because it's like,
I will say it's just wild. The first the first two screeners I got from Nightstream that I watched today were eons better than anything I've seen at other fests this year. There's a lot of good stuff that didn't make the other fests.
And I had to skip it.
Really exciting.
There's just so much going on that I just couldn't do Nightstream this year.
They'll all be on Shudder in 6 months.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
It's like what Donna, I think, in Twin Peaks says. She's like, it's like I'm having the most beautiful dream and the like most horrible nightmare at the same time.
Yes. Well, that's a perfect way to close out, because, I mean, I don't even know where to begin to promote for the Losers Club stuff. I mean, we got our first Dance Macabre episode next week, which is going to have us going through all of the inspired works that King talked about in his Dance Macabre book. So the first one is going to be Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, which we tied to, you know, because Flanagan's The Haunting of Bly Manor is next week, so I figured people are going to be in on Hill House again because we're going to be revisiting it, so should be a great discussion. Mel Castle actually teaches classes on Hill House, so she'll be leading that one. Very exciting. Then we have our It reunion panel for Salem Horror Fest, which we did two sessions on and just got really emotional, got really great, really fun, excited for that, and excited to see the cut for it finally on that. We just finished it last night. And then we have, we're talking about other authors. We're going to be doing a bunch of Creepshow stuff with that's tied to the Halloween special, hoping that, we should be getting a one-on-one with Greg Nicotero, which I'm hoping, cause I just want to go all in on King with him. Look, the calendar's everywhere. We've put it on socials. We put it on Patreon. You could find it. And once again, if you haven't, Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us some bright red Pennywise clown noses. We could use it. We deserve it because we are your favorite, your devoted, and your only Losers Club. Until then, we'll be seeing you over long days and pleasant nights. I got some hot friends.
This is the end of our show, for now. We hope you enjoyed this production. If you like our programming, consider searching for other Bloody Disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.